We've talked a lot yesterday and the day before about the American elections, and however they turn out, policies generally won't change. Freedom, hopefully, will be defended. But what really made me angry today were the reactions of several Arab governments and officials of Arab governments who had the temerity to say that the results of the American elections were a message to President Bush and to the West about the horrors, and that one minister used that word, inflicted upon the Arabs at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. So they had the audacity to compare Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo to the slaughter in the streets of Baghdad of Muslims by other Muslims, and trying to draw a political equivalency on that. And it won't be long before that's going to be picked up by the chattering classes and salon liberals of the left in the West. But history won't let them get away with it. Tonight, between tonight and Saturday, we're caught in a very, very meaningful period, a period of series of days that should sear our souls. 68 years ago, when Hitler was in power in Germany, he had proclaimed a one-day boycott against Jewish shops. A law was passed against kosher slaughtering. Jewish children began experiencing restrictions in public schools. In 1935, the Nuremberg Laws deprived Jews of German citizenship. By 1936, Jews were prohibited from participation in parliamentary elections, and signs reading "Jews not welcomed" appeared in many German cities. Sound familiar in some of the Arab world? But in the first half of 1938, numerous laws were passed restricting Jewish economic activity and occupational opportunities. In July of 1938, a law was passed requiring all Jews to carry identification cards. On October 28th, 17,000 Jews of Polish citizenship, many of whom had been living in Germany for decades, were arrested and relocated across the Polish border. The Polish government refused to admit them, so they were interned in relocation camps on the Polish frontier. Among the deportees was a man named Zindel Grinspan, who had been born in Western Poland and had moved to Hanover, Germany, where he established a small store in 1911. On the night of October 27, Zindel Grinspan and his family were forced out of their home by German police. His store and the family's possessions were confiscated, and they were forced to move over the Polish border. Grinspan's 17-year-old son Herschel was living with an uncle in Paris. When he received news of his family's expulsion, he went to the German embassy on November the 7th, intending to assassinate the German ambassador to France. Upon discovering that the ambassador was not in the embassy, he settled for a lesser official, Third Secretary Ernst von Rath. Rath was critically wounded and died 2 days later on November the 9th. The assassination provided Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's chief of propaganda, with the excuse he needed to launch a pogrom against German Jews. Grinspan's attack was interpreted by Goebbels as a conspiratorial attack by, quote, international jury, his words, against the German Reich, and symbolically against the Führer himself. This pogrom has come to be called Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass. And in the nights of November 9th and 10th, gangs of Nazi youth roamed through Jewish neighborhoods, breaking windows of Jewish businesses and homes, burning synagogues, and looting. 101 synagogues were destroyed. 7,500 Jewish businesses were completely burned to the ground, and 26,000 Jews were sent to concentration camps. Kristallnacht, tonight, turned out to be the crucial turning point in German policy regarding the Jewish question, as they called them. And many historians consider it as the actual beginning of what we now know as the Holocaust. And the world remained silent. Through everything I've read to you in the 1930s, the world remained silent because the world perverted truth and took and twisted reality to suit the fact that they wanted to do nothing. But today something remarkable happened. It's not only the 68th anniversary of Kristallnacht, but today, for the first time, in the city in which many of these laws originated and propagated, a new synagogue was dedicated in Munich, the first one since the war. And if you think that I am angry tonight about the Arab world's reaction to an American election, it doesn't compare to some of the emails I've received. And I want to read you one from a listener named Ellen. And it begins with quotes of some of the words used by some of the Arab countries and European countries. Profoundly shocking, gravely disturbing, devastating and disproportionate, massacre. What are they talking about? The accidental bombing in Beit Hanun by the Israeli Air Force. of a building close by to which were rocket launchers. Israel has taken over 2,000 rocket hits from Gaza after they pulled out. They've suffered the complete destruction of cities like Sderot. Ellen continues, somehow these words are never used to describe Israeli victims of terror. The very same people who now call for international intervention failed miserably to respond to Rwanda, the Congo, Darfur. In fact, while Islamofascism casts a long and ugly shadow across Europe, Europeans still insist on dancing what she calls the Chamberlain Tango. Never emphatic toward Jewish victims of terror. Israel, for them, is somehow a moral resort area. But tonight, the shadow of Kristallnacht should knock some sense back into the Europeans and hopefully will remind Western liberals, in quotes, of what freedom is all about. And we're going to examine on this night, in the face of the words of nullification and interposition that are arriving from Arab capitals, the strength of Israel and the strength of a sister democracy, because in the words of John Kennedy, Israel and freedom were not created in order to disappear. They will endure and flourish. They are the children of hope. And they are the haven of the brave. They can neither be broken by adversity nor demoralized by resistance. They bring honor to the shield of democracy, and they carry high the sword of freedom. And it is that challenge that we've always pursued on this program and we'll continue to discuss tonight with our first guest right after this. And as I said in my opening remarks, tonight I am angry, and I am angry at the words coming out of Arab capitals that having to do with the American election. One has nothing to do with the other. We have planned to have our guest with us for some time now, and it is good that he is here tonight, not just because it is Kristallnacht, not just because it is important to celebrate the freedom of a sister democracy, but because of the egregious reaction from many Arab capitals on the American election. Our special guest is Igal Palmore, who's director of the North African, Syrian, and Lebanese Department of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Jerusalem. Igal has been with the ministry since the early 90s. He was at the Madrid peace talks and has held many high-level positions and been a participant. I was looking for the right word, Igal, has been a participant in a variety of capacities. I'm going to be very diplomatic here, in many of the groundbreaking conferences that have sought a road to peace, regional conference in Casablanca and Cairo and others. Igal Palmore, welcome to Quebec, to Montreal, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You heard what I said in my opening introductions. I know you've had a busy day briefing public officials in Quebec City. How does one react in Israel, being a professional diplomat, as you are, when you hear the kind of language that comes out of Arab capitals latching on to anything to pervert any actions in the West and draw a line of moral relativism, political equivalency, as is being done over and over today, this comparison about Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, this is a message, America, get out of the Middle East, you know, let us kill ourselves.
The results of the American elections. I find it funny that people who never run for office, who don't even know what an election is, they never saw it from very close, they always read about it in the papers, never happens around them, never happened to them. People who don't know what an election is pretend to interpret the results of an election in a real democracy. I find that a bit presumptuous. And my reaction, I think it's funny.
What is the situation in Israel today post-war politically. We've been hearing of investigations of the government, calls for the resignations, investigations of what the army did, what the prime minister did fail to do. Where is this heading? Are we going to see early elections in Israel? Are we going to see changes of government?
Well, people seem to be very angry about the way the politicians handled the war and about the way the army managed the battles. People think that the army underperformed, and so did the politicians. There was massive support for the government when the war started. When Hezbollah attacked Israel, people thought that enough was enough. Of course, Israel's reaction was not about that particular incident. It was about 6 years of recurring infiltrations, incursions, rocket firing, terrorist attacks from Hezbollah on the border.
From Hezbollah in the north and in the south from Gaza. People
and
forget,
from Gaza.
1,000 Qassam rocket attacks destroyed the city of Sderot, and Israel was silent.
Yes, there was an accumulation of, you know, people grew fed up of all this. So when the government said, look, enough is enough, we need to put an end to that, people massively supported the government, whether people were left-leaning or right-leaning, they all supported the government. And in the end, after the war, there is a general feeling, whether it's justified or not is another issue, but there is a general feeling of disappointment. And the army hasn't quite met the expectations that people had. So now, obviously, people want officials to be accountable. They want investigation committees. They want people to.
We're going to take a short break, but I want to ask you about a story that's not getting enough play in the West. We've talked about it, and I want to ask you why right after this. And our special in-studio guest is Yigal Palmor, the head of the Syrian, Lebanese, and North African desk of the Israeli Foreign Ministry. And we're going to be joined by a very special guest from Jerusalem Online in just a moment. Yigal, I wanted to pursue what we were talking about before the break. Prime Minister Olmert, at the beginning of the war, tried to do it as an air war, letting 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 soldiers cross the border, telling them, come back at night, never letting them stay on territory they had captured. Finally, the last week of the war, Wednesday, the Security Cabinet authorized the use of the army, not just the Air Force. He still doesn't unleash the army until Friday, and in 36 hours, some 20,000 Israeli troops cut through Hezbollah territory like a knife through butter and went to the Litani River. Suffering, those 20,000 suffered 19 casualties. The original 5,000 to 8,000 suffered 60 dead. How come that story of the success of the Israeli army, the infantry, has not been put out there more than it has?
I don't know. You should ask the media outlets. I mean, the story is out there for everybody to see and to cover. I don't know why some media outlets simply ignore that and choose to do other stories. I simply don't know. All I can tell you is we didn't use ground troops all along that war because we wanted to make it very clear both to the Lebanese people and to the international community that we're not... We don't have any intention of occupying Lebanon. You know what people said throughout the world. Yes, Israel wants to occupy Lebanon again. Israel wants to annex a chunk of Lebanese territory, which was totally not true. So we refrained from using ground troops. We thought we could do in the Hezbollah from the air. Well, that was a tactical mistake, of course. And then in the last days, it was what was needed was to push forward in order to convince those who needed to be convinced at the UN that if they don't vote for the Security Council resolution, the text that was on the table, then war will continue and that will not be good for anybody because people still needed convincing, believe it or not, at the UN. The text was theirs, was agreed, but it was very good. It described reality for a change, and people were reluctant to vote for it. So the ground operation of the last month was needed in order to push forward a diplomatic initiative at the UN. That worked.
Noga Tarnopolsky from Jerusalem, award-winning journalist, dear, a good friend. How are you? At 2:26 in the morning.
Yes, because it's very late. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Noga.
Hi.
Noga. Yigal, I know you know each other. Noga, Yigal has just said that Israel, that the policy of the prime minister had been not to launch a major ground offensive because they didn't want the image out there that they were going to occupy Lebanese territory. Is that the general accepted notion, or was the prime minister Olmert just looking at the polls and afraid to call up reserves?
No, I don't think it was a matter of afraid to call up reserves, but I do think there was an internal psychological element, which is that at the same time that, as Igor just said, he was eager to reassure the world that Israel had no intention of capturing Lebanese territory, I think he also wanted to reassure his own populace here in Israel that he had no intention of leaving soldiers permanently on the ground in Lebanon. So for a while, returning them every evening was sort of a pacifier.
A pacifier that did it really buy anything in terms of public relations?
It's hard to know right now. I think that the Israeli population is under tremendous stress. The government, it's unclear almost week by week how stable the government may or may not be. The population is under constant barrage in the sense that we feel, I would say, on the one hand under attack, for example, the missiles on Sderot, and on the other hand, as if there's nothing to do because all of the Israeli military offensives have so far ended either in what appears to be tragedy or what appears to be at best a mixed result. So I would say there's tremendous stress and confusion, and it's difficult for me to answer your question beyond that.
Noga, let me ask you a final question. I know it's late, and we got you in a little later than we thought. Since about 4 o'clock our time in the afternoon, all we've been seeing three Arab capitals, Syria particularly, in Lebanon, where foreign ministry officials have been saying that the American election results were a message to Bush that he cannot pull any more Abu Ghraibs and Guantanamos. Those are specific quotes, and the CNN and the networks are looping this. So there, you've got Arab leaders or people in leadership positions comparing the stripping of prisoners to massacres and bombings. How do you, as a journalist, relate to that, and how does Israel fight that off? How does the West fight that off? Because we know it's going to be picked up by the left very shortly.
Look, this is a monumental issue that you've just opened, which is the general failure of the press to properly cover the complications of the Middle East. I don't know how deep we can get into this right now, and you have sitting next to you one of the top experts on exactly this area.
And we're going to get to it with him, but I wanted to get your opinion first and let you get back and get to sleep.
Yeah, I would say that outlets such as CNN are also under great pressure to offer a constant loop, 24 hours a day of news, and so that essentially any stupidity, any facile, demagogic reaction by any government that is located in such a hot and related area of the Middle East, such as Syria, gets an inordinate amount of coverage, much completely out of proportion to what its strategic or diplomatic importance really is. And I would characterize it as a failure of the press. You know, the statements issued by Syria show a deep misunderstanding of what democracy is, a deep misunderstanding of the United States, and are basically irrelevant comments. They should be relegated to line 27 of the report.
They should be, but unfortunately they're up front and center. Noga, thanks very much for staying up late and giving us your input, and we will continue this with Yigal.
Good
night, Montreal. We'll be right back. And our special guest in studio is Yigal Palmore, director of the Syrian, Lebanese, and North African desk of the Israeli Foreign Ministry. Yigal, Noga Tarnopolsky from Jerusalem just said to me that I'm sitting with one of the experts in how to answer bad PR or ridiculous statements from Arab governments. So what is the answer to answering Arab officials who equate things like Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo with the kind of slaughter that Muslims are perpetuating around the world and against their own people?
Well, I would say send them back to the textbooks. Of course, they're not speaking on behalf of freedom of opinion or freedom of speech. I don't think these expressions of mostly propaganda should be taken at face value. I think they should be taken for what they are. They come from regimes who know nothing about democracy and freedom. They know all about preserving the power of a ruling caste, and they should be understood as such and nothing else. So why would they be equated with the words, with quotations from politicians in countries where politicians are actually elected and reflect the opinions of the people? There's no comparison here.
Yigal, let's get back to from the general to the specific in your specific areas of expertise. John O'Sullivan of the Hudson Institute, will be joining us later, has called the recent war the first Israeli-Iranian war. He believes there's a second one coming. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. How is the international deployment working in Lebanon, in South Lebanon particularly? What is the situation with Hezbollah? Are they getting stronger? Are they getting reinforced from Syria? And does this international contingent have any legs to it in a 1701 working, Resolution 1701?
Well, first of all, it's there, the international contingent. It's there, it's reinforced. It's been there since 1978, not doing much and not doing much good. It let Hezbollah do whatever it pleased, raid Israelis across the border. They even took some video images once when the Hezbollah kidnapped Israeli soldiers back in the year 2000. So they weren't doing much good. But this time they have... hopefully, not only more troops on the ground, but clearer instructions and stronger mission statements. So they should be much more efficient in the enforcement of law and order.
Yet they're not under there under a Section 6 UN mandate. They can't do combat.
That's right. But this Security Council resolution that sent them there is specifically ambiguous about this Chapter 7
right.
thing, because it wants
Let's just explain to our listeners. Under a Section 6 mandate, UN troops can engage in combat. Under Section 7, they can only do self-defense, correct?
Exactly. So they are supposed, under the mission statements that they got, under the instructions that they have, they are supposed to be there in order to enforce law, in order to help the Lebanese army, the legitimate Lebanese army, to deploy in the south, something that the Hezbollah prevented from happening for years, in which we Israelis asked the UN to help them do.
And the Lebanese refused for 6 years.
The Lebanese refused because they were afraid of Hezbollah. Hezbollah is terrorizing the whole of the Lebanese society. Hezbollah is not only a danger to Israel. Hezbollah is a state within a state inside Lebanon, making Lebanon an empty shell for the Hezbollah virus to thrive on. And so this new international contingent is supposed to not only impose an embargo on arms shipments to Hezbollah, but also to help disarm Hezbollah. There have been two or three security
Have they been successful on the question of arms and Hezbollah, or has Hezbollah managed to rearm itself through Syria?
Unfortunately, they haven't even tried to disarm Hezbollah. They've refrained from doing that, so that's a very weak point.
And neither has the Lebanese army that's been sent out.
Neither has the Lebanese army. So Hezbollah is now boasting greater stock, a greater arsenal of missiles and rockets. Now, I don't know if we can take their word for it, but when Hezbollah leader Sheikh Nasrallah goes on TV and says, I had 13,000 missiles before the war, I now have 33,000, well, it does mean something. It means that he can rearm freely. Nobody is there to stop him from doing that. And maybe he doesn't have 33,000. Maybe he only has 20,000.
But what you're saying
care,
is...
I know that they're all aimed at Israel and that we will need to take action if the UN doesn't.
And what you're saying is the rearming has continued through the Syrian corridor.
Yes, absolutely. Through the Syrian-Lebanese border, not only a corridor. This border is... Oh, by the way, Syria doesn't recognize Lebanon as a country and doesn't recognize
its border.
It's always
thought of itself as greater Syria.
It refuses to have diplomatic relations with Lebanon. Syrian intellectuals who call for the government to establish diplomatic relations with Lebanon are thrown to jail. So the whole border is open for anybody to smuggle stuff through.
Hold the thought. They're motioning to me again. We've got to pay some bills and have a traffic report. We'll be right back after this.
Okay.
And our special in studio guest tonight is Yigal Palmor, director of the North African, Syrian, and Lebanese Division of the Israeli Foreign Ministry. Yigal, before the break, you were telling us about the rearming of Hezbollah. How dangerous a situation is this going to be? The international force really can't do too much if Nasrallah decides to launch rockets.
No, it won't fight Hezbollah. I think that if Hezbollah actually decides to fire rockets at Israel again, then Israel will have to protect itself again because nobody else will. Nobody else will. So we will do that. But we hope that the new situation created in Lebanon, the political weakening of Hezbollah, will allow the UN troops on one side and the Lebanese army on the other to curb in Hezbollah and, you know, not to allow them to use their arsenal again. Hezbollah is now feeling terribly weakened, and it issued an ultimatum to the Lebanese prime minister. It said last week that if they don't get one-third of government ministries and a veto right on any government decision, well, they should take action. Now, nobody knows what that means, but it certainly doesn't mean anything good. So people in Beirut are preparing for Hezbollah action.
Against Lebanon.
Against Lebanon, of course, because Hezbollah is Lebanon's greatest enemy. And Lebanese understand that. What Lebanese have said lately, recently, about Hezbollah, not one Israeli has dared say. The criticism that we've heard from Druze, Maronite, or Sunni Muslims in Lebanon against Hezbollah has surpassed anything in violence and in...
One small ray of hope. Let me ask you one final question before I bring in our next guest on the line with us, and this will expand the conversation. The first day of the war, the Israeli Air Force did knock out some 45, I believe they were called Zalzil missile sites, the Iranian long-range missiles that could have reached Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Yes. Has there been any evidence of Iranian rearmament of Hezbollah?
Well, Hezbollah has been rearming. Where do the weapons come from?
Iran through Syria?
Iran through Syria, exactly. And also from Syria, we have captured some Russian rockets, Russian-made rockets that were shipped originally to Syria. They were shipped legally. They were bought by the Syrian Defense Ministry from the Russian government, and they ended up in the hands of Hezbollah. We provided proof to the Russians, and, well, they promised to do their best that this should not be happening again, so we'll have to take the word for it.
At this point, it is my privilege, as always, to welcome John O'Sullivan, Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute, Editor-at-Large of National Review, a former advisor to Prime Minister Thatcher. John O'Sullivan, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's nice to be here again.
John, in studio we have Yigal Palmore, who's the head of the Syrian, Lebanese, and North African desk of the Israeli Foreign Ministry. And we've been talking about the rearmament of Hezbollah and the threat Hezbollah poses to Lebanon, not only to Israel, and the missiles aimed. And I believe it was you who coined the phrase, the first Iranian-Israeli war.
Well, I'm not sure I was man who actually coined it, but I certainly...
You used it.
That was the last... That's a good description of that war.
Go ahead, sorry.
I was listening to your previous guest, to your other guest, rather. I was reminded of something, and I wonder if you would agree, but there are many signs that in the present Lebanese situation that remind me of the situation in Jordan in 1970, prior to Black September, when the Palestinians, the PLO, was flexing its muscles, in effect beginning to dominate and threaten the Jordanian state. And of course, as we know, King Hussein of Jordan launched a very savage attack and destroyed the PLO for a temporary period and drove them out of Jordan.
But Hussein had a more disciplined army than Lebanon does.
That's exactly the point I was going to make, that the forces within Jordan at the king's disposal were stronger, and they were more loyal too. The army was loyal to him. It was a tribal loyalty almost. I don't see anything of that kind of strength available to the Lebanese government, which anyway is itself divided, and after all, Hezbollah's part of it. So I myself would feel that if there is a fight to the finish, it can't be conducted solely by Lebanese forces alone. They're going to have to get assistance from elsewhere. And obviously, Israel is not in an easy position to deliver that assistance, and I wonder where else it would come from.
The destabilization that we're seeing in the region, there seems to be a strengthening of a sort of east-west axis, Iran to Syria to Hezbollah. I won't say Lebanon, although I believe the Lebanese government is complicit by its inaction. And you recently reflected on the fact that the Saddam Hussein verdict is really not something that we should run into the streets and celebrate, but it's a time for, as you put it, somber reflection. Can this have any destabilizing effect on what is already a growing and heated situation on that Iranian-Syrian Hezbollah line?
Well, I think that it has an effect on the Middle East for two reasons. First of all, it warns and alarms the despotic rulers of the Arab world. If you're the ruler of Egypt, of Syria, the sight of Saddam Hussein, one of the dictator's club, going to the gallows is a very frightening sight. It makes you absolutely determined, it seems to me, to resist what has been the Bush administration's policy up to this point of encouraging democratization in the Arab world. At the same time, the same sight of Saddam on the gallows gives some hope to those forces which are against the present regime. Some of those forces are Democrats, we would welcome greater influence going to them. But some of them are Islamists, radical Islamists, who actually would impose a more savage and disciplined dictatorship in the place of the present rulers. And that all these people are going to be encouraged by what's happened. Now, this places the Americans in a difficult situation. I think, particularly now that we're seeing a change, changing of the guard in Washington itself.
And on this point, I want to open the question to both of you right after this break. And our very special guest tonight, John O'Sullivan, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, editor-at-large of the National Review, and Yigal Palmore, head of the Syrian, Lebanese, and North African desk of the Israeli Foreign Ministry. And gentlemen, I want to throw this question out to both of you. John, you, the American election. I started the show actually around 4:30. I started to my monitors, all my news monitors in my office. The repetition by American networks and even some British networks of statements coming out of Arab capitals saying this election shows President Bush and the West that they cannot pull off Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. So they're equating the stripping of prisoners to the wanton slaughter of Islamists and, in fact, the slaughter of Muslims by Muslims. So, gentlemen, what effect, if any, short-term or long-term, is this election going to have? Preferably short-term, I think that's what we have to focus on right now. Yigal, John, either one. John?
Well, first of all, the election had nothing whatever to do with Abu Ghraib. I can't think that more than 1 in 100 voters had it on their mind.
Oh, of course not. This was a comment from the Syrian foreign minister that CNN is looping for 2 hours before I came into the studio.
But they're fooling themselves. But there is undoubtedly going to be a change, and the appointment of Bob Gates, the soon-to-be-released report of the Baker Commission, are going to push events in a slightly different direction. In a very general sense, I would say this. The Americans are going to go much cooler than they have been on the democratization policy because they simply do not want any more Islamist governments being elected as Hamas was in the Palestinian Authority. And they're going cool on that. There'll be a much sort of more self-interested, cooler, and less interventionist U.S. policy on this one.
You go.
Yes, well, I try to think about consequences for, you know, American-Israeli relations. I don't think there will be any consequences. There will be continuity. It's not like the Bush administration is pro-Israel and Democrats are anti-Israel.
Not in Israel, but will this encourage groups in Lebanon? And will this encourage a more aggressive Syria?
So I think that the implications will be around Israel, as you've just said. Some terrorist groups or some extremists might actually take seriously all these interpretations by the Syrian foreign minister and so on, and think that this is really the sign of a great change, and they can maybe they will think it's a sign of weakness, and they will try some operations to undermine American presence or American efforts in the region, not only in Iraq. Generally speaking, extremists always interpret democratic moves as a sign of weakness, and they never learn. So one effect might be that some extremists might take this too seriously as a sign of weakness and maybe try some action. But what exactly and where, it's impossible to tell.
John O'Sullivan, Yigal Palmore made the point earlier in the program that Syria has never recognized officially Lebanon's border because it considers Lebanon part of greater Syria. Nasrallah and Hezbollah tried to make the Sheba Farms an issue by saying the Sheba Farms are Lebanese when the UN recognizes it as Syrian. Do you have any feeling that I don't want to say a weakened government, but a weakened American resolve will embolden Syria to get in on the action in terms of territorial acquisitions in Lebanon, which will then put the Middle East, that corner of the Middle East that is Israel, Lebanon, and Syria, destabilized?
I think that the Syrians at the moment are waiting to see what's in the Baker report, because the general feeling is it's going to suggest that the Americans try to forge some kind of a deal with Syria. And I don't think the Syrians would want to rule and to make that an impossibility by taking some aggressive action at the moment. So I don't think that's likely. Of course, if these smoke signals turn out to be wrong, that could change.
That's a very interesting point you're making. You're suggesting that the Baker Report might suggest a deal with Syria that's a client of Iran's?
I think that the Baker Report is, if the leaks that we hear are correct, it's an important qualification, it's suggesting that the Americans should effectively deal with the Syrians and also, by the way, with the Iranians, with a view to getting their assistance in stabilizing the situation in Iraq, which means that they expect that the regime that emerges in Iraq will be one that is acceptable to these two countries. And that's what they're looking for now, rather than the democratic one in particular, or even they think stability will best be achieved by a deal with their neighbors.
John O'Sullivan, Yigal Palmore, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we are caught in a three-day period that starts tonight, where man's best hopes for civilization were destroyed in chaos and anarchy and death and destruction on Kristallnacht. On Saturday, we commemorate man's best hopes and man's best efforts to restore that. A gentleman named Terry Kelly wrote this after an incident on November 11th, 1999. Kelly was in a Shoppers Drug Mart. Some died for their homeland in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. Some died. Now it's and at 10:55, look at his little an announcement came over the store's PA system asking customers for other dads who to take 2 minutes of silence at 11. 2 minutes, would you mind? It's a pittance of time. And almost everybody did. Except one man who was at the checkout counter, and he just refused. And this made Terry Kelly so angry that he wrote this song, A Pittance of Time. And I'll just read you the first verse. They fought and some died for their homeland. They fought and some died. Now it's our land. Look at this child. There's no fear in the eyes. Could he not show respect for others who've died? Pour leur patrie, ils ont perdu la vie. Pour leur patrie, ils ont payé le prix. Maintenant, nos enfants ont des yeux qui sourient. De respect, s'il vous plaît, car des pères l'ont permis. 2 minutes, je vous prie, c'est si peu de temps. Pour les filles, les garçons qui sont partis au loin, qu'ils reposent en paix, qu'on n'oublie jamais leur mort. C'est si peu de temps. Take 2 minutes, would you mind? It's a pittance of time for the boys and the girls who went over. In peace may they rest. May we never forget why they died. It's a pittance of time. And as we go into this period from Kristallnacht to Remembrance Day on Saturday, maybe the most poignant words come from the song of the partisan units who fought in Europe. Never say that you're going down the final way, because the darkened heavens hide the blue of day. The time we've longed for will at last draw near, and our steps as drums will sound that we are here. Thank you, Tor Shogren. Thank you, Montreal, for listening. We'll be back with you on Monday.